We all know how valuable photos and video clips of a loved one are. But have you thought about capturing their full story in their own words as an audio podcast or as a video? At GK Media, we've been working with families, hospices, and nursing homes across Ireland over the past 10 years to help preserve precious memories. We help you celebrate the voices, special moments, and wisdom of your loved ones by recording your meaningful conversations together. Record in our Galway studio, or we can travel to you bringing our own recording equipment. Whether it's a tribute, life story, or message for future generations, we capture it with care and compassion. Visit gkmedia.ie/legacy and let us help you tell the story that deserves to be remembered.
There are very few places in the world where you don't have to explain your grief, where no one expects you to smile or pretend. This is one of those rare places, a quiet, grounded day where you can simply show up exactly as you are. On Sunday, October 19th, we'll gather for the grief workshop at Fitzpatrick's Castle Hotel in Killiney, Dublin, a peaceful place by the sea, created for anyone carrying grief. Throughout the day, you'll be gently supported by expert facilitators, people who understand grief and who offer real tools to help through movement, breath, journaling and stillness. You'll be guided back to yourself in quiet, compassionate ways. And you'll be in a room with others who get it. There's something powerful about sitting with people who don't need you to explain anything because they've felt it too. The setting is calm and beautiful, a soft place to land, to breathe, and to take time for yourself, time that's so rarely available in everyday life. By the end of the day, strangers may not feel like strangers, because when grief meets grief, something shifts. Some people leave with lifelong friends, others leave with something softer inside. And maybe just as importantly, you'll have spent time remembering your person, honouring them quietly, without distraction, without apology, because they deserve space too. Early bird tickets are now available at griefireland.com. Spaces are limited, and if it feels right for you, I'd love to welcome you. Hey everyone, just before we begin this week's episode, I have a quick favour to ask you all. If you love the show, it would mean so much if you could take a moment to follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to right now, or share it with a friend, tell them all about it, or leave a quick comment. And when you see the videos on social media, please comment there too, because it really, really helps me to keep this podcast going. Thank you all so, so much.
Hi everyone, we're back today, and today I'm joined with the lovely Sequina O'Brien. My God, did I have to practice that? Sequina. And Sequina is from?
I'm from Westmeath.
And how did you get that name?
I don't know myself, but I was born early when I was younger. So I was born 3 months early, and it was like given to me for good luck because I was obviously quite a sick baby.
Wow.
Because it was a Celtic healer of the River Seine in France who like specialised in healing things that primary babies would struggle with. So it was given
That's
to me
class.
For like a bit of good luck, and I'm still here. So I guess
oh,
it worked.
Oh, lovely. I love that name.
Yeah, thank you.
So unusual. So you do your thing over on TikTok mostly.
Yeah, TikTok mostly. I started out on Instagram, but I'm more on TikTok now, on the both of them, obviously, doing my makeup, and I share a bit about my grief journey and all of that stuff and fashion and stuff like that. So
that's obviously why you're here today.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose you're known for doing makeup
yeah.
and those cool transformation.
Creative looks.
Yeah,
and
I love
stuff
it.
Like that. Thank you.
But obviously, you know, what you see sometimes online is not a whole person's life.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
So today I'm going to probably bring you back to the start and just, I suppose, tell me a little bit about your family of origin and who they were and where you come from and all
that. So I'm from the countryside in a tiny little village, and I lived with my parents growing up, my dad and my mom, Fintan and Maeve, and then my brother and my sister, both older than me. And
What was your brother and sister's name?
My brother's name is Phelan, and then my sister's name was Royaltine.
Yeah, no, you're okay. Don't worry. Don't panic. We're
let me
chit chat you into it.
Yeah.
Okay, so growing up, you had your brother and your sister. Phelan. Phelan.
Yeah, another Irish name.
And Royaltine. Yeah. Like, oh my God, the names. Love it.
Thank you.
As you're growing up, typical Irish family, no, nothing out of the ordinary. And when, I suppose, did things in your household change a little bit in terms of, I suppose, your sister, if we start there?
So from as long as I can remember, really, my sister was 6 years older than me. So from my earliest memories, I always do remember her struggling quite a bit with her mental health. She was on the spectrum as well. She had Asperger's, ADD, ADHD, like obedience defiance disorder, a rack of different things, basically, the poor devil. OCD as well, she kind of started struggling with when she was only 9 or 10. So, like, very, very young to, I suppose. And a lot of it came from bullying. Like, I remember she swapped around. She went to loads of different schools, you know, because of the bullying and stuff like that. And just feeling different with the autism and that kind of stuff. So I always remember there being an element of that there when I was growing up.
She obviously got all these diagnoses and stuff?
Yeah, the diagnosis is, funnily enough, it actually kind of tipped her over the edge a bit, because she didn't get diagnosed until she was, I think, 15, and she just took it really badly. The news wasn't delivered to her great, and then afterwards she didn't get any, you know, appointments on how to, like, learn how to deal with the autism and the news and stuff like that. She just took it as, I'm so different, and kind of, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the poor thing.
Yeah.
And I suppose in what way would, I suppose on reflection, did you see that she was anyways different?
I never thought so.
Right.
But yeah, I was always kind of her like best friend. She really struggled with like friendship, making friendships and stuff like that as well. So I was always kind of like her main friend. But obviously there was a bit of the age gap there, like, you know. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, your parents and stuff obviously decided, look, let's go and chat and see if there's anything that can help.
Yeah, my parents were constantly trying to get her help, and through the HSE, just like counselling and stuff like that. But, you know, it was kind of weird because she struggled with her mental health and then the autism as well. But in this country, for some reason, you have to either decide if you want help with your mental health or with your autism, and they won't give you like treatment or sessions for the two of them. So she chose the mental health, and then she never really got any help with the, you know, with the autism.
So you
and
can't
handling
get support
it,
with both?
No, for some reason.
That's insane.
Yeah, it is insane.
But not surprising either.
No, not surprising either, no.
No.
Yeah.
And so in terms of her mental health, obviously behind the scenes, or maybe unknown to you because you were younger, her mental health was poor.
Yeah.
She was struggling with it.
Yeah.
And even from conversations now, do you have any awareness of how she was struggling with it or how that was unfolding?
After she got her diagnosis when she was 15, she basically dipped after that, and she started starving herself. She developed an eating disorder, anorexia nervosa, and that had a massive toll on her. Obviously, it's one of the, you know, most deadly like mental health disorders you could have. Like, it's, you know, so she started starving herself and losing lots and lots of weight, and obviously thought she was massive, and she wasn't, she was a twig, you know.
Wow.
And then, yeah.
Can you remember that time, like, as in, were you watching this? Like, I'm sure there was a lot of stress around you in the house and
everything.
Yeah,
there was, definitely, even just from my parents constantly trying to help her, and then as well a lot of people with eating disorders and stuff like that, you know, they think you're lying to them when you're trying to help them, because their brain is telling them something different. So it's hard, like, it causes a lot of aggro, like, you know, even just to the people that are trying to help you.
I'd love a tiny bit more understanding about it, because I really just, I'm interested in eating disorders.
Yeah.
Because I feel from the research I've been doing into them, they're all very related.
As in,
even though someone who's massively obese and someone who's massively underweight, it's all about control.
Yeah.
And one person control what they take in, and binge eating, but then it's the flip opposite, but they're all the same.
Yeah.
You know?
They're all just as serious as well, like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so did she get help then with that?
I remember when she had her 17th birthday in a hospital, Lindara in Dublin. It was for eating disorders. So she got in there and she was in there for maybe 9 months trying to do like a recovery program. She got brought in there because I remember my mom bringing her over and back to the doctors trying to, you know, say she's not well. She's so skinny. She'd lost so much weight. And the doctor was just kind of sending her home, kind of acting like my mom was a bit of a helicopter parent, you know, the way it goes.
Yeah.
And then my mom brought her in somewhere else for a second opinion. And they said that she needed to go to the hospital straight away because she could go into cardiac arrest at any minute. Basically, that's how low her heart rate was because of how skinny she was and how underweight she was, you know. So she went into hospital for 2 weeks, just the general hospital, and then that's when she went into Lindara. But she didn't really get much better in there. Like, I do remember her really hitting it in there, you know. Obviously they had to sit in with her to have her meals and, you know, all that stuff. And yeah,
but she've got a lot of mental health support in there.
I don't think she got too much support for the mental health, no counselling or anything like that. It was really just they bring you in the food and they sit with you while you're eating it, and you know, have the doors open while you're in the shower, making sure you can't throw up and just all that kind of stuff. Like, really? Yeah. And there was all different types of people there, like with different things as well. So, you know, kind of a loud environment and not like.
Yeah, okay, so it's like, it was not specifically for eating disorders.
Well, she was in for that, but I think there was people there other with other things as well. Things. Yeah, but also a lot of other people with eating disorders, which I remember her looking back on and saying that it was kind of a bit bad because, like, comparing yourself to other people and who are also doing the same thing and, like, you know, yeah, ruminating in it with each other, you know, that kind of thing,
yeah,
can go
sure
on a lot. So, yeah.
It's just interesting because, you know, sitting beside someone and telling them to eat,
yeah,
is not the answer.
No.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of the treatment facilities would be very big on counselling and therapy.
Yeah,
and
that's
all
what
that.
It's all about. Like, it's necessary, you
yeah
know? You need your whole brain rewired, basically.
Yeah.
You know? It's, yeah.
But then not getting the support for, you know, the other complexities,
mm-hmm,
not getting support for that, because it probably all plays in. I know ADHD is a huge driver for people that binge eat, let's say.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, if it's not all looked at,
yeah,
as a whole,
yeah,
then you're gonna struggle,
yeah,
you know,
definitely,
to get support.
And however bad we thought it was, I suppose when she was under 18, when you're over 18, then like there's even less help, you know.
Really?
Yeah, there's even less services and all that stuff.
So when she got out, then how she did a couple of months there?
Yeah, she did a couple of months there. She actually got out, and they didn't realize at the time. She only told us afterwards. But for her final weigh-in, because she had to reach a certain weight for them to discharge her, for her final weigh-in, she had managed to sneak weights into the hospital and had them in her pockets or something like that to make her a bit heavier on the scales, you know, which is not uncommon for somebody with an eating disorder. It kind of makes you, what's the word?
So by having the weights, it
yeah
makes her heavier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But as in kind of like, you know, you're always trying to like, not devious.
Oh, I feel like sorry, I get you. So they're deceptive.
Yeah, deceptive. It kind of makes you deceptive.
That's
yeah
a characteristic.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, I've spoken about addictions on here,
mm-hmm,
and the lovely Owen McGraw. And
yeah.
And he talks about how you would lie and lie
yeah
and lie. You become a horrible
yeah
person.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to protect what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So
definitely.
That's, did you find that she was like that, even
yeah
to you guys?
Yeah, she was, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so when she got out then, where did she go from there?
Just back home. Then she turned 18 and things kind of started to go downhill from there. She was struggling a little bit with drink, I think, drinking a bit more than she maybe should have been, but she didn't have like a main addiction issue yet. And then one day, something happened. She got upset about something and she went off to Dublin and she met a paedophile up there, basically. But she turned 18 at this stage. So she was obviously, but with the autism, like mentally, she was younger. Do you know what I mean? Like, she didn't have as much common sense when it came to boundaries or, you know, seeing like a bad person from a good person and that kind of stuff, social cues, you know. So she met him and she thought like he was just like nice and like a friend and like, you know, kind of just got brainwashed from him basically. And people actually call him the puppet master, is what he's known as up in Dublin, because he's so many young girls all around the county on strings basically, like, do you know.
Wow.
And he ended up like drugging my sister up basically on things and feeding her tablets, stuff like that. She was in a lot of dangerous situations and stuff like that when she was up there, staying with bad people, you know, and just being taken advantage of completely. Like, he only had her up there so he could take her money every week basically, you know. So yeah, but she was kind of oblivious to it all, and then it was too late because she was hooked on everything. And obviously when you're addicted to everything, like, you know, you just want to go back up and get it, and you know, like, so she'd try to come home, sober up, and then she might go back up again, and do you know, that kind of way. So yeah, that was tough. That started when she was 18 or 19, and she was actually like missing for a couple of weeks at one stage. Like, we didn't know where she was, like no form of communication from her or anything like that. It was very hard on my parents. Obviously they were worried out of their mind, and then there was nothing that they could do for say because she was over the age of 18, so they couldn't get anybody involved, even though she was so vulnerable and getting abused and all that stuff, you know. So yeah.
And that was obviously so hard on you as well.
Yeah, yeah. I was maybe 13 at the time, I think, when it started kind of with the addiction. And then it was heroin then as well. So that's like the worst of all drugs, really, like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see her at all, like, during that period?
I did. I do remember my mom getting me to stay in my granny's house the odd time, just because at home is always very explosive, like, you know, a lot of screaming when you're trying to, you know, wean somebody off drugs, like at home detox. Obviously, that's like, you know, especially heroin, that's like very explosive. So my mom didn't want me there at the time. So I'd stay in my granny's house maybe for a week or two, like, well, things were really bad. But I was there for a lot of it. I did see a lot of it and most of it. And
would you have known when you were going to your granny's something was going on?
Oh yeah, no, I knew about all of it. Like, my parents never really didn't tell me. Well, obviously when I was a certain age, but when I was that age, I knew what was going on. I didn't understand it as much as I do now, but
you knew it was like an addiction, or
So that lasted, I want to say, maybe a year and a half. And then after that, it was just a constant battle of trying to get her sober and, you know, trying to help her. And she was really struggling with her mental health, and just, you know, after being in all these abusive relationships and all of that. And then during this period, basically, so nothing changed as in she got better. That's when I found out that my mom was getting sick. And another thing that I forgot to add was that my mom was my dad's carer, because he, my whole life, has had chronic pain. He's fibromyalgia and a few other stuff. So she was always his carer and kind of the worker in the house and all that, you know. So anyways, so then for me, I was always used to seeing my dad sick growing up. Like, I was always, you know, my dad was in pain every day. So I was used to him being the sick one and my mom being the well one. And then obviously when we found out that my mom got diagnosed with cancer, it was like, I was like, what, you know?
So your dad, when you were growing up, had, what did you say it?
Fibromyalgia.
And what is that?
It's a chronic pain condition, basically. So it affects all of your muscles, and just means that he's in pain every day, basically. He got it in his early 20s. Now it flares up and flares down. Some days he would have been bedbound with it, and some days he's okay to get up and move around. But yeah.
Okay, so he, as long as you've been alive, he's had this condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, obviously then, as you're dealing with your sister's addiction and all of that, your mom had always been well. And then what happened that all of a sudden she began to feel sick with her symptoms?
So there was symptoms, but she was putting it down to the menopause, which happens a lot of women, middle-aged women, So my mom got gastric cancer, so it's basically stomach cancer, and a lot of the symptoms from that get mixed up. If you're going into the GP with it, they'll be like, oh, it's just the menopause, you know. So that's what she was told for months and months, but she was just putting it down to the symptoms. And I suppose, you know, everything else going on at the time, she wasn't minding herself as much as she should have been, like, as on the ball with it, you know.
She probably was full of anxiety,
exactly,
and worry,
and
that's
just,
in
just,
your tummy, isn't it?
Yeah, and just caring for everybody else, you know, like, her focus wasn't on herself. But the last time she went to the doctor about it, he actually told her that she was pregnant.
Wow.
And she was like, oh my God, it's like the Immaculate Conception. she was like, oh, how would I be pregnant? So imagine saying that to somebody. And then the next day she was in the doctor, they were like, oh, it's actually like a tumour in your stomach. It's like, that's a bit of a difference from a pregnancy to cancer, you know?
So did they send her off to the hospital for tests?
Yeah, sent her off to Dublin. My parents didn't tell me about it straight away until they figured out exactly what it was, I guess. So I remember being in my granny's house the day that I found out, and I heard my parents pulling up outside. I don't know where I thought they were for the day, to be honest. And I was like, oh yeah, they're back. And they came in, and then they just said to me, mammy said, oh, I'm so sorry, I have cancer. And I was like, why are you apologising? It's okay, you know. And that's just the kind of person that she was. She was always like, she said the whole time that she was sick, she was apologising to us, because she was like, oh, it must be so much harder for you guys because you're the ones that are going to have to live on without me. And it's just like, oh, what else, you know, it's hardest for you, you know.
Yeah.
And we didn't know how bad it was at the start, I suppose. I was 15 then at that time as well.
So you were 15, mm-hmm. and then so how that all played out. So your mom, obviously, did she head for treatment then?
So she done 9 months of chemotherapy, I think. Mm. So looking back, I don't know. You know, it made her very sick. God love her, but she did want to try. She wanted to do immunotherapy, and you have to complete all the rounds of chemo over here before you actually do the immunotherapy, which is a bit mad because the chemo kills your immune system and the immunotherapy, you know, works on your immune system. But
yeah,
so she done that, and she also, we had her on RSO oil. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No.
It's short for Rick Simpson oil. It's basically cannabinoidal oil.
Yeah.
But it's really good for cancer. And we were blessed to have her on that because it honestly made it all a lot easier on her. We knew from the days that she didn't have it, she was in bits. And the days that she did, she was she didn't look half as sick as she should have been, because when it was diagnosed, it was actually stage 4 and inoperable and all that anyway. So, you know, she kind of should have been in a wheelchair at the start of her diagnosis and all that, and she was still up and about, and you know.
Yeah.
So
what way then, once she started her treatment and all of that?
Yeah, I remember listening to her all night just in the bathroom, getting sick and reaching and that, you know, and it was heartbreaking, it was. But she'd kind of, I think she'd done it every second week, so, you know, at the end of the 2 weeks, she'd be kind of back to herself a bit more, and then she'd have to go and get it again. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
But yeah.
And all the time, what was your sister still struggling with?
Yeah,
this stage?
My sister just was overlapping. It was overlapping the whole thing, which was really difficult, because my mom just, she lost the energy. She, you know, she just didn't have the energy to put into trying to help my sister as much anymore, of course, you know.
Yeah.
They were kind of both overlapping each other. And then my dad wasn't very well at the time either, obviously. So, yeah.
So for you at that time, obviously, what age were you when all this was happening?
So when I found out that my mom had cancer, I was 15.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I suppose within a year, it was really kicking off and she was sick and all
of
that.
Yeah.
And so then when you're at home and your dad is sick, your mom isn't doing well.
No.
Your sister isn't doing well.
Yeah. So, I had a massive plot twist as well at the time. I was actually, after just finding out that I was pregnant when I was 15, I think I found out the day before I found out that mommy had terminal cancer. So I was just
wow.
So that was, and then obviously there was a lot going on with my sister and stuff. I didn't want to take away from it and add to the stress, because in my mind, stress is just causing more sickness all the time. So I kept that bit of information to myself and decided to deal with it myself and get an abortion myself without telling anybody. And I suppose that's a whole other area of grief kind of as well.
For sure.
I feel like it's not talked about so much, because there's a certain sense of, you know, you feel like you shouldn't, you don't have the, sorry, I'm trying to think of the word.
Yeah, no, there's a shame around it.
Yeah, there's a shame around it for sure. And you don't feel as entitled to go through a grieving process for it, because, you know, you think of all the poor people that have miscarriages and baby loss and stuff like that. And it's different, but it's still hard. And there's a lot of judgment from other people on that topic as well, and guilt that comes with that. But, you know, the guilt that you kind of would have yourself, that's
really hard.
Well, yeah.
So you were obviously 15. Were you in a panic like when you found out you were pregnant?
Yeah, I was.
And with all that going on in the house, you didn't obviously didn't feel you could tell anyone.
No, I didn't. I just didn't want to, you know, make in my head, obviously, at the time. Now, looking back, I wish I had, you know, now that I'm a bit older. But at the time, I was like, you know, it's my fault. Like, I need to sort it out myself. Like, what if it makes my mom more sick by, like, you know, and like the stress. So
did you just go? You obviously had to travel, or did you know?
Well, I was lucky. There was a place that had opened up because of COVID, like online, that sends you out abortion pills. I went down to do that process, but it was difficult because I was under 18, so I couldn't go to the hospital about it without a guardian or a doctor's or anywhere like that. I was very lucky. My partner at the time helped me out a lot with it. But he was the only person that knew and that I told. And so the whole time my mom was sick on the chemo and stuff, I remember we went away. We used to go to Strandhill every year to Sligo. And I remember we went away for the last time to Sligo in the caravan. I remember we were getting the train up and she was down sick from like the chemo. She was really nauseous on the train and I was dying sick with like travel sickness. Just, it was like, you know, I'm not telling anyone. So
after you've obviously had the abortion, I'm sure you were struggling internally yourself, but then you're a child, you're 15. You're not even probably able to decision making, you know, skills. And then, but were you left, I suppose, a bit traumatized or upset by that privately?
Privately I definitely was, but I also think I pushed it down a lot because there was just so much things that seemed a lot bigger and more immediate going on around me that I was like, these need my focus, you know. So I tried to just focus on that. That was maybe 2.5 months after I'd found out that I got the abortion. And then the focus was back onto my mom, obviously, my sister. My mom done really well. She done actually really amazing with the Orasol oil until month 9. She hadn't needed any other painkillers or anything like that, which was amazing, you know, that she wasn't even on morphine and all, like at least half the time with the stage 4 cancer. She started to get more, you know, obviously the symptoms were getting a lot worse and she was, you know, the cancer wasn't shrinking from the chemo or anything like that. And she went into the hospice for a few weeks and she said that it was to try and like recover, to get well enough to come home. And she'd just been approved for the immunotherapy. So she was like, this was in April. So April 2022. So she was delighted to be approved for the immunotherapy. And it was the first bit of kind of positive hope, if you will. So she went to the hospice to, as she said, kind of recover. But me and my dad have talked about it since, and we think she just didn't want to see us, or she didn't want us to see her as sick as she was, I think, in a way. She came home then, and I think she was only home 2 days. The first night she slept in the sitting room. And the second night, my dad stayed in with her in there, and it was really lucky he did because she started to get kind of a bit manic that night, like just really hot and bothered and, you know, kind of stressed. And she was on morphine at this stage when she was in the hospice and everything. So we kind of thought it was something like that, but it was actually sepsis. So she obviously had sepsis a bit in the hospice, but see, they don't do blood tests over there or anything. So that's a bit why we were like, fuck, maybe we should have had her in the hospital. It would have been kind of noticed straight away, because obviously sepsis is like, you know,
deadly.
Yeah, deathly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I remember I was in bed, but she collapsed anyways that night. I think it was maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up to my dad screaming to, you know, get me up. And I went to ring an ambulance for her. She was on the ground, like my dad had tried to pick her up and everything already, and his back went when he was trying to pick her up because he didn't have the strength. So we just had like blankets underneath her on the ground and on the floor. I think we waited for an hour or so for the ambulance to get there. But when I was out on the phone to the ambulance, my dad says, like, he swears that she died for a few seconds on the ground and like came back. Like, he said that her face tilted back and she kind of let out that gasp, like, and stopped breathing for a few seconds. And like the eyes kind of rolled back to the back of the head as well. And he just was saying a prayer that was stuck up on the kitchen table about an angel or something, or on the wall, and he was just reading that over her. I'm not sure why, you know, in the moment, like, you don't know what to be doing, do you? And he said just like a few seconds passed and she just shot back up and she was still there, thank God. And then she was still alive, obviously, to make it to the hospital. And, you know, we said the whole time she was sick, we were asking for like a blessing or a miracle that she'd recover. But like my dad said, like, he thinks that was kind of our miracle that we got to hold on to her for my sister to see her in the hospital and say goodbye, and my brother and myself and him, like, you know, and for us to all be around her. So we kind of took that as our little miracle, I suppose, if you will.
So when you got to the hospital, were you told, you know, this isn't good, or was she conscious?
Kind of in and out of consciousness. They had to give her like a, is it called a cataract, you know, the bag, and some stuff like that. They had her on a lot of morphine, like she was in a lot of pain. And I'm not sure when they copped that it was sepsis. They did cop it was sepsis, obviously, but they forgot to give her the antibiotics to combat that for like the first night and something like that, which was a bit of a joke because like that's why she was in there, that's what she needed. But yeah, I suppose we kind of knew that she was at the end of life because she got moved then from maybe the second day that we were in the hospital, she got moved into palliative care. So that was when we were like, okay, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when she finally passed, were you all there?
I was in the room. I was actually just, I remember I was just looking out the window, like talking about something that was outside with my dad, and we didn't even like hear her go or anything. We just noticed that she kind of stopped breathing, and he went to check her pulse and he couldn't find it. So I went down the hall and I was kind of shouting for the nurses, just come in and check. And yeah, I remember that like very vividly.
You were devastated.
Yeah, devastated. I was 16 at this point then. So
young.
Yeah.
Like, do you mind if I ask what's it like? Because I have so many people that have children.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say people who've lost a husband or a wife, and they're always so worried about their children.
Yeah.
Like a 16-year-old you who had been through so much, like at that moment, you know, what was going on for you, or how did you feel?
Just absolute heartbreak, like probably the worst emotion I've ever felt in my life, you know. Just wanted my mom, and then she was gone all of a sudden, you know, so it was not nice. But also I was worried about my dad too, and how he'd cope without her, and, you know, my sister, and, you know, all of that. There was a lot to worry about. There was even obviously completely separate, but really shitty that my mom was worrying about this when she was dying, is the fact that obviously my dad couldn't work, so she was on a carer's allowance, and she knew when she died, and I was still in school, so I couldn't work. So she knew that when she died, we'd be down like half our income, and like she didn't know what we were going to do, and she was trying to sort all of that out for us, but she was still here, bless her. Yeah, just motherly stuff right until the end, you know.
Yeah. That's a real concern.
Yeah. Because actually, then of course, when my mom died, I was then my dad's carer, and there's no carer's allowance for under 18-year-olds over here. Like, you can only get it if you're over 18. So that put me in a really, really awkward position for 2 years when I was in school. You know, we were living off like €200 a week, and it was just not enough, you know. Had to start a GoFundMe page. I also had a GoFundMe page when my mom was sick, trying to raise money for her treatment and stuff like that.
That's really hard.
Yeah, it was hard. It was, you know, a little bit embarrassing for me because of the age I was, to try and be kind of plastering it all over online, like asking for money, like at the time. Like, obviously I wouldn't feel like that now, but
you know, other option really.
Yeah, no, and look, I was so thankful for all the support. I think we raised something like €6,000, which, like, you know, she wouldn't have been able to stay on the oil that we had her on without it. So it was, you know, it was great. You know, people in times like that, you do realise how great people can be as well, like especially even just strangers, and the kindness of strangers that understand what you're going through, and other people who've gone through grief. And, you know, one in three people, isn't it, die of cancer nowadays. It's like, you know, every second person you bump into that is connected to it somewhere, or has a loss, you know, so, you know, because of it. So
how was your grief after your mum was gone? How did that manifest in you?
I was just really depressed, I suppose, but I kept on going, and I feel like I didn't process. I feel like, honestly, I'm only processing it the last year. Like, you know, I was kind of in denial, even though I knew it happened. What I was doing for the 6 months after she died, I was just trying to keep myself as busy as possible. And I was telling myself that I was doing really well because of all the distractions I was constantly giving myself, you know, that type of way. So that's what I was doing. But at the same time, I wasn't able to do anything else. So like it did get me through it. I was just doing my makeup and doing my art and, you know, trying to focus on that. But also my sister went into psychosis, drug-induced psychosis, because she decided she wanted to get completely clean. She didn't even want to wean herself off of it. This time she, you know, she just never wanted to touch another drug again, basically. But that is dangerous as well. It can send you into psychosis. So she went into psychosis pretty much when my mom died. I want to say maybe a few days after, like maybe 2 weeks after or something.
So when your mom died, your sister was living in the house also?
Yeah, on and off. She had been over in a hostel in Athlone because it was just a bit much, like, for my mom, them both being in the house. But yeah, she came back after my mom died. She was at home trying to get clean, and my dad and me were trying to help her, obviously. But then when she went into psychosis, that was kind of the next 6 months straight.
Wow.
Or maybe 4 or 5 months. So that whole period straight after my mom died was about trying to help my sister, trying to make sure she wasn't next, you know, that kind of thing. So I definitely didn't grieve during that period. It was just
stress.
Yeah, just stress, just constant fight or flight mode.
You're 16.
Yeah, 16. Yeah.
That's really, really, that's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a queen. Like, yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah.
As a 16-year-old, like, you know, mm-hmm. looking after your dad, your mom is gone. And your sister is really struggling.
Yeah.
And you love her so deeply and you're trying to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was the psychosis like?
Was it dangerous?
Yeah,
it was horrendous. Like, she just completely lost her mind, basically. Like, just to give a bit of insight of how bad it was, like, she was crawling around on the ground on all fours, like, thinking that she was, like, a pig, like, and, like, you know, probably because of the anorexia. She said all she was able to talk about as well was how fat she was and, like, that she wanted to die. And that was basically the only two things that would come out of her mouth. Like, that's how bad her mental health also was, if you get me.
Yeah.
But she was hallucinating and hearing things that weren't there and constantly talking to herself. We'd try and put her in front of the TV to kind of keep her busy, and she'd just be talking really random stuff that makes no sense, like, back to the TV, and just, like, her mind was completely gone, you know. So we were trying to get her into our local mental health hospital, because we didn't know what else to do with her. Like, she couldn't be at home, she was too unwell. Like, she could have hurt herself or somebody else, you know. But it was ridiculously hard to get her help when she was in that state. Nobody would take her in. The hospital in our jurisdiction actually refused to take her without even assessing her after she got referral from, like, the doctors or wherever, you know. But basically she was bounced in and out of the hospital. I want to say they discharged her 3 or 4 times in the span of a couple of weeks, which was detrimental to her recovery, in my opinion, because, you know, she should have been on the meds to try and pull her out of the psychosis, like, you know, as soon as she went into it. Because if you're in that deep of a psychosis for too long, like, it will damage your brain and you might never come out of it, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So we'd have her in, and as well, because she was over 18, it just made the whole thing so stressful. I want to say she was 21 at this stage now, but, you know, the hospital wouldn't have any contact with my dad because she was over 18, even though she was, you know, she in no way could mind herself or, like, cognitively think about the best thing for her at the time because she was so unwell, you know. So she did need somebody else to be able to do that for her, but we just weren't allowed into the care plan. Into if they were releasing her, they actually released her without telling us, without sorting anywhere for her to go while she was still in psychosis. No phone, like, didn't know how to even use a phone because she was so, you know, in the middle of town. And we found her the next day, because she was walking around my auntie's house. I think she, you know, some part of her brain remembered where that was. And she was found basically in the nip, like, in her underwear in a bra with permanent marker, like, scribbles written all over her. I don't know where she'd been for the night, like, taken advantage of. She said that she was raped. And, you know, somebody else had obviously done all this on her. And she just looked insane and so unwell. And I was like, you know, I seen her that day. And I was like, how did they discharge her like that and not even let us know or make sure that she had a house to go to, at least, you know? Because we would be ringing trying to check up and, you know, So that was insane and like scary, because all the only option we had was to try bring her back again, try get them to take her in and help her, you know. And even somebody, like people were ringing ambulances for her if they'd see her outside, because that's how visibly unwell she was. And, you know, like, and then the ambulance bring her to the hospital. The hospital would write a referral for the mental health place. And that just went so on so forth for 2 months, I want to say, until they properly had her in, like, kind of, you know, admitted.
Okay.
A bed in there and stuff. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, it was like very, very stressful as well, of course.
That's terrible. This is all in the aftermath of losing your mom.
Yeah, yeah.
Within those 6 months.
Yeah, all with it, straight after, you know.
Jesus. Because my,
yeah, yeah, so.
Distress.
Yeah.
It's tremendous.
Yeah.
And so then did she get proper care when she was finally admitted?
No, not really, to be honest. They didn't give her any care. So she was in there in the end for nearly 6 months, I want to say, in the end. Or
in the local hospital?
Yeah.
In the mental health?
Yeah, in the mental hospital, basically. She was in, maybe it was more 4 or 5 months
okay.
that she was in there altogether. And she didn't get any counselling the whole time she was in there. They didn't really have any activities for them to do. Like, she was just hallucinating all the time. She was terrified in there. And just really unwell, wasn't making any progress, wasn't really getting any better. And like, mind you, we didn't just leave her there for months or anything like that. Like, we would come in and take her, check her out every single day. My dad would check her out every single day for lunch or for just a few hours, bring her out to the house, like try make her dinner, try get her to eat, because she was losing weight rapidly in there as well. They actually said to her that she didn't have anorexia, which she did have anorexia, you know, from a very young age. And that's a crazy thing to say to somebody who did have an eating disorder, because even if you do meet a set weight, which she wasn't above a healthy weight anyways at the time, but even if she was, you don't just say to somebody you don't have an eating disorder, because the eating disorder never goes, you know. It's, you know, it's yeah. It's a mental problem. So you might be above a certain weight, but if anything, when you're above that certain weight, you're more likely to just crash and need a bit of extra support, because you could be a normal weight, but for the person with the eating disorder, they think they're massive and they're way more likely to start starving themselves and just kind of, you know, do you know what I,
yeah,
what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's dangerous to say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like, and then obviously then she was like to us, oh, I don't even have, and it's like, you do, like, you're not eating, you're starving yourself. And the more she was starving herself, and it's like, the less sense her brain was making, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, because she couldn't think even clearly. Anyways, she had the first meeting. I was under 18, so I wasn't allowed to be involved in anything. It was really difficult. But she had a first meeting with the doctor in there, I suppose, in the 6 months that she'd been there. And the doctor was sitting up on the chair. You probably can't even see me, but like, had the legs crossed like that. Yeah. You can imagine both of them, with her shoes off, like, I don't know, just really chillaxed. And
the doctor had the shoes off,
that she'd been waiting months to see. Yeah, so they had promised her kind of accommodation and stuff when she'd gotten better, like help, support, what's the word of it,
like outside support,
yeah, accommodation,
community,
like,
support,
yeah, a bit, yeah, exactly. So she'd been kind of, you know, like looking forward to that, in a sense. It was giving her a bit of hope. And in the span of the meeting, basically, they told her that she was too unwell, because she'd made no progress. She was too unwell to stay in the hospital. She was too unwell to go to rehab, even though at this point she was clean for 7 months. So, like, she was, which is very good accomplishment, when we're talking about heroin, you know. And they said that she was also potentially brain damaged from her psychosis, and that they'd, like, you know, test her for that, and that she'd have to be, like, leaving, basically, or whatever, like, along the lines. But basically the whole meeting, just that she'd been waiting months and months for, it just ripped the last shreds of hope out that she had. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was, yeah.
Was she speaking to you about this? Like, when you had conversations, would she say this? Like,
no,
was there moments where she'd say, I'm just fed up and this
not
is
so much, but, well, yeah, like, when she'd be out at the house, she'd just be talking about wanting to die and how fat she is, and that's kind of all that she was able to come out of her mouth, like, you know, it's all she could think about. Which showed what a bad place she was in. And then, yeah, they told her that she was potentially brain damaged. They never actually checked that. They let her out for leave, which they shouldn't have done by herself, but they did, without telling us, obviously, because we weren't involved at all. So they let her out for unaccompanied leave, and she went down to Sligo, which, by the way, is where we scattered my mum's ashes, because as I was saying, we used to always go down there. And somebody rang an ambulance on her because she was trying to take her life down there. I don't know, was it something in the sea or something? And somebody seen, thank God, and rang an ambulance, and she got sent back to the hospital. And, you know, my dad wrote a letter to them, and he was like, under no circumstances is she to be let out unaccompanied without at least informing us again in case something like that happens, because she could have died. And at that stage, she'd be safer at home with us where we can actually watch her all the time, you know. So, yeah, he sent that letter off, and they took away a couple of days of her leave, as in we couldn't come out and take her out for a couple of days. That's all they'd done, maybe 3 days. And then, I'm not even joking, less than a week later, they let her out again. Maybe exactly a week later, they let her out again. Didn't tell us, let her out on the grounds. They keep your wallet, your ID and your person stuff in a little locker so you don't have access to it. But for some reason, they gave her all of that, even though there's no shop on the grounds, keep in mind. And they had told us that it was only... that they, she was only let out on the grounds for a walk, but yet there was no nurse with her making sure. And keep in mind, this hospital, the gates are wide open. It's not like locked in or anything. You can just walk straight out into town, all the shops around you. So they gave her her phone, her ID, her wallet, which is obviously then enabling money to go get whatever you want, you know. And that was the end of my sister then. That second mistake, she went and walked down to the shop and got 2 litres of vodka, and she went back to the site and sat underneath a tree and drank herself to death, basically, I think, because we still haven't gotten her autopsy back, even though it's nearly 3 years ago, and wow, they usually come back in 9 months. But yeah, so...
So she took the 2 litres of vodka and drank it?
Yeah, I assume that that's what done it, you know, because she was found with one beside her, you know, but she wasn't even found then for 5 days. It took 5 days for them to find her body, even though it was on the hospital grounds as well, you know.
Oh my gosh.
They were just kind of, yeah.
So did they raise the alarm that she was missing?
They rang us and they said, did you take Realty Now? And my dad was like, you know, no, we take Realty Now when we ring you every time first, say that we're outside, check her out, sign her out, whatever, you know. And we wouldn't be allowed just to come out and take her out without informing somebody. So he was like, why? Like, where is she? You know, because we thought she was just there. And she'd actually said to us that day that she was going to just stay in the hospital that day and not bother coming out. And we were like, oh, okay. Didn't think that anything was going on. And then they rang to be like, oh yeah, we can't find her. We let her out a while ago. And we were just like, oh my God. Like, we were like, oh my God. Because just the week beforehand, we were down actually at Cork for a funeral. And we weren't there the first time that they'd let her out. And we were like straight back down, driving down to see. And then thank God somebody else had found her. But me and my dad just went straight into town. And we were just looking anywhere we could think of for her. We were, first place we checked was the canals, like all that kind of stuff, you know. And the police were looking for her as well, made up missing persons posters. We were kind of hoping that maybe she was just gone off to stay on someone's couch and, you know, like maybe relapsed again or something. But we had a really bad feeling at the same time because of what had just happened and because of how incredibly suicidal she was for the last few months. So yeah, then the 5 days went by and they eventually found her on the grounds there. But it's funny because they even said to us when we were looking for her, she's definitely not on the grounds. We looked on the grounds, so then we never went and looked at the grounds for her, which is also frustrating because what if we did and we found her and she could have gone to hospital and maybe got her stomach pumped and maybe might still be with us. But there's always what ifs, of course, you know.
That's such a failure.
It's such a failure from the system, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So can you remember, obviously you can, the moment they told you they'd found her?
Yeah, I was in my auntie's house and my dad came in and told me, I think. Yeah. But it was exactly 6 months after my mum had died that she died, maybe 6 months and 2 or 3 days or something like that. So it was like very close as well. So it just felt unbelievable. Like, I felt like I wasn't even living my own life. Like, I was looking at it from an outside perspective, kind of, just because of how crazy it all sounded. I was like, how is this actually happening to me, you know? But yeah, so.
Wow. That's just
crazy.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And then we weren't even really able to get anything done after about it, like, for, you know, legally, like, injustice, which is even more crazy. Like, I thought that surely, you know, it's miscare and it's, you know, it's not right. But, yeah.
What? You were told no?
No, the HSE, like, you know, they have themselves covered basically every which way with stuff like that. So we did try and spent a couple of grand actually just last year trying to, before the 2 years was up, because you only have after 2 years of the person dies to try and get the ball rolling with bringing it to court and stuff. But we didn't get anywhere basically. So they'd never release her files to us or anything like that either, because they said it was confidential. And stuff like that, which is mad, but yeah.
And so obviously you got her back. Did you get to see her, say goodbye?
Yeah, I done her makeup for her funeral, and I done my mom's makeup for her funeral as well, because I don't know, I just felt like at the time, like, it felt right to do it for some reason, even though I know that probably sounds a bit weird for some people listening.
Listen, you're in the right corner here.
Yeah.
We get this. It's not weird at all.
So I just didn't want someone else doing it. And like, well, especially with my sister, because she was really particular about her eyebrows, and like, I didn't want them to put the wrong shade of lipstick on her, you know, stuff like that.
It's a nice thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so you had her funeral then?
Yeah.
I'm sure that was like a blur.
Yeah.
So soon after your mom.
Yeah, it was.
What age were you at this stage?
16.
Well, still 16?
Yeah, I was 16 when they both died. So.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And I was obviously in school, like, and all that as well. So then that happened. And then a couple of weeks after my sister died, maybe 3 weeks after my sister died, my dad got really, really, really sick with like a neurological disorder that I'd never had before. And like that nearly killed him as well. So then I want to say the next 5 months after that was me 24/7 caring for him, trying to, you know, stop him from losing his life as well. And I thought I was going to be left as an orphan at one stage, you know, I was just like, oh my God. And it was tough not having my mom there to help me. You know, I was just trying to do everything that I thought she'd be doing and, you know, all the same things. But it was hard to get doctors to listen to me and stuff like that, because I was under 18, and a lot of the time they'd be, you know, not listening to me. But my dad was so sick that he couldn't even speak himself at points. So, like, you know, I needed to be advocating for him and all that. And I did my best. But then that was another couple of months period that I didn't process any of the grief at all, of course, you know.
He ended up in hospital.
Oh yeah, he was in hospital. I'll just briefly explain what the condition is. So basically, it's called cluster headaches, which is a bit of the name doesn't do it much justice. It's a 9.7 on the pain scale, the attacks that you get with this, and it's all pain in your head. Childbirth is a 7.5 or something like that. So like, it's ranked even worse than childbirth. So you can imagine, like, you know, and they're basically you get these attacks every, synchronically, like clockwork, every couple of hours. So he was having maybe 4 a day. They'd last for like an hour or two. And it just feels like your head is in a vice, like the worst pain imaginable. And all you want to do is just take your life, like, to make it stop. You know, they're known as suicide headaches is what they're labeled as, because so many people who get them, that's what they do, because they're just too much. And they're also, there's not enough research done into them with meds and stuff like that. Like, it's hard to, there's nothing you can take to make it any better, you know? So that was incredibly difficult, because I was then missing months and months of school, minding him. And, you know, when I say 24/7, like, I would be sleeping in the sitting room beside him, like, every single night for months, and I'd be up all night. He wasn't sleeping at all at the time either. He was getting like 8 to 10 hours a week. So he was, you know, obviously that's an insane lack of sleep. And there was just no help. Like, again, we were left in a position where there was no help. And I just felt so lonely. You know, especially being under 18, I thought that maybe there'd be something or somebody that could get involved and give us a hand, you know. But I genuinely just felt like I was being left to rot away at home, you know. And just, it was really, really stressful. Yeah. So it was tough, but we got through it. And then the next year he got them again because they come like seasonally the same time every year. So
is he still getting them?
Thank God he's not gotten them this year. He's in like the same time of the year and he's managed to not get them somehow yet. So I'm just praying that they, you know, stay away. Like I did manage to find him like people who really specialise in the condition in the UK and raised money on GoFundMe for him and got him like as much treatment as possible and all that. Kind of had to seek further seas than Ireland to get any help with it. Like we needed an urgent care to even get the diagnosis. Like he figured out what he had by himself by having to look it up and stuff. A doctor didn't even tell him. And then it was confirmed by the doctor in the UK who specialises in it, but he couldn't get a diagnosis over here because neurologist appointments 10 months maybe quickest. And you know, day to day I didn't know if he was going to survive like another day going through the amount of pain he was in. So it was like, yeah, had to go look further afield. And the power of social media really, really helped me through the second time with it. Like I ended up just having to resort to sharing some videos and stuff like that of him at the time because I just didn't know what to do. And people were amazing. And if it wasn't for all the support we got online, like throughout that period, he says himself as well, he just doesn't think he'd be here at all anymore. And I believe that. And, you know, he was in so much pain that this is probably going to sound crazy as well, but it was actually at a point where I would have understood if he couldn't do it anymore. And if he, you know, like I would have understood because I love him so much. Like, and you wouldn't put a dog through the pain he was in. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just, you know, I would have understood. I didn't want him to suffer anymore, which is insane. Like, it shows how bad it was for my mind to have even been there when I was 16, 17, just after losing my mom, just after losing my sister, and to be able to even have that thought process about it, I suppose. Yeah.
Jesus. It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. I don't really know if, obviously I know the whole care and stuff isn't like grief, but...
oh no.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It's like... still, yeah.
This is your life, like, you know?
Yeah, somehow.
Yeah.
Somehow.
What age are you now?
19 now, yeah. Turned 19 in March. And I just done my leave insert last year, so.
Did you?
Yeah.
So did you have to pause it for a little while?
No, you know, a lot of people were saying to me, you should repeat and stuff like that. I was like, no way. No, I just, I wanted to get out of school as soon as possible because I'm a creative person and, you know, like I just wanted to be doing
my own books.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hate the books.
And you got through the leave insert?
Got through the leave insert. Yeah, it was difficult because that so happened to happen in basically fifth and sixth year. The last time my dad got really sick, that was in sixth year. So that was all going on while I was meant to be doing my leave insert. Now I made it in for the exams, but you know how you have mocks and stuff first? I was at home minding him by myself, like for the mocks. I couldn't leave him at home. So I didn't even do any of the mocks, which is like the pre-leave insert, which really freaked me out because I'd missed out maybe 5 months of sixth year at home minding him and maybe the same for fifth year. So that's like over half the course. And then, yeah, I was lucky enough I'd done TY when my mum was sick. So I wasn't in fifth year when I, you know, so I just didn't matter losing time when that happened, you know. But yeah, it was hard to catch up because I kind of had to do it all by myself. Like I didn't have that much extra, I didn't have any extra support in school really or anything like that. So yeah.
That's incredible.
But yeah, I still passed my leaving cert somehow.
That's phenomenal.
I don't know how.
Hold on. Can we have
probably
a minute here?
Just for the art section, I think. But you know.
That's phenomenal.
Thanks.
It's really incredible. You know, you've been through so much. My God. Do you feel like you have even...
I feel like I've lived 100 lives
already.
Yeah, a little bit.
Do you feel like you have grieved even properly, or do you even like the weight of all you've been through?
To be honest, I still don't feel like I've processed things fully. And I think maybe because it was my mom who passed first and then my sister, that really the last year I've been thinking about my mom a lot more. And like now I feel like I'm just starting to process things with my sister, and that's kind of hitting me a bit more now, if you get me. So yeah, it's taken a long time, and it was just my mom's 3-year anniversary just gone past in May. So you know, 3 years sounds like a long time to me. It sounds like a long time away from her. It feels like a long time away from her. You know, I struggle to even remember what things were like before she got sick, and like, you know, and then I also worry because it's sad, like, you know, losing a parent young, because I feel like I don't have the most clear memories when I'm under 10. And then when I think about it, I'm like, I only have 6 years of like proper memories I can remember as such. And that upsets me a lot, obviously. But yeah, I'd say it would be another, you know, you never really, you know, process it fully, I suppose. It's been hard, but just one step in front of the other. And I think genuinely all you can do is just take it one day at a time. And, you know, one thing that I really tried to do, and I used to always say at the start of when it happened, was I was just trying to focus on how lucky I was to have experienced like love so strongly for them and from them, that it hurts so much having them ripped away from me, and, you know, even having them in my life to be ripped away from me in the first place. Like, I was just trying to be happy for that, but you know, at the same time, obviously it's shite, you know. But
yeah, for sure.
Yeah
Well, you are a wonderful, and
thank
I don't
you.
Want to sound, I don't want to sound like,
I know.
but you really are.
Thank
like,
you.
You've been through an awful, awful lot. And I hope that you can, you're so young to, I don't know, there's a lot of life to go yet. But as you said, you've probably lived 110 lives.
Yeah.
more knowledge and wisdom and experience than someone who's 3 times your age.
Yeah, I think it matures you a lot as well. Definitely being in adult situations all the time, you just have to kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you are a wonderful person, and I just wish you a lot of luck and a lot of peace.
Thank you. Some luck would be good.
Yeah. As you go along your journey, because it's a long road and you've lost so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hope you can be good to yourself and know that you're a great person who's
Thank you
been
so
through
much.
A lot, and you're carrying a lot.
And you too. And I think it's absolutely amazing what you're doing with the podcast for grief and stuff, because that's all you can do sometimes, is just share it and talk to people who understand. And I'm without a doubt, it's a real help to so many people who listen. Just being able to relate to other people. And
where can people find you? On TikTok.
Yeah, you can find me on TikTok at Sequina Makeup.
SEQUANA.
Yeah, that's the one. And my username is the same on all the apps, basically.
Okay.
So,
okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Sequina.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.